Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much for being here. Thank you very much. It's wonderful to have such a big audience tonight's event. Let me start with a disclaimer. I am not Sir Stephen Sedley. So I'm sorry if some of you feel shortchanged. Unfortunately, Sir Stephen was a bit unwell, so he couldn't be with us tonight. Nothing serious, but serious enough to prevent him from being here. I am Emmanuel Melissaris. I'm an associate professor of law here at LSE Law, and I'll be chairing this event tonight. An event which is a celebration of the publication of Conor Gyaty's latest book on Fantasy Island, Britain, Europe, and Human Rights, a book which came out by Oxford University Press just a couple of months ago. Conor is, of course, director of the Institute of Public Affairs here at LSE, as well as Professor of Human Rights Law at LSE Law, but also a barrister and a founding member of Matrix Chambers. But perhaps more importantly, Conor is a prominent public intellectual and a passionate public defender of human rights. And Defend the Human Rights Act is exactly what he does in this wonderful book. He provides a robust defense of the Human Rights Act, dispelling what he argues are myths supporting the anti-Human Rights Act rhetoric. Apart from Conor, we're also honored to have two distinguished academics to discuss the book with Conor. Shauna Douglas-Scott holds the anniversary chair in law at Queen Mary University of London, where she's also the co-director of the Centre for Law and Society in a Global Context. Her work and extensive list of publications covers a very large range of fields, such as human rights law, public law, EU law, and legal theory. She has provided advice and drafted reports for a number of public bodies and is currently special advisor to the Scottish Parliament European and External Relations Committee Brexit Inquiry. Steve Pearce is a professor at the School of Law, University of Essex. His research interests and numerous publications focus on various aspects of EU law. He is also a publicly engaged academic. He has worked as a consultant for a number of public bodies, including the European Parliament, the European Commission, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, and many more. He is also a prolific blogger. His EU law analysis blogspot.co.uk blog is a very rich source of information on topical matters relating to the EU, as is his Twitter feed, I must say. Now, some housekeeping notes. Bear in mind that the event is being recorded, and a podcast and a video will or should be made available soon, probably early next week. But we're also live streaming the event tonight. So we're catching up with the 21st century here at LSE, always at the forefront. You can also use Twitter. You can use the hashtag LSEBrexit to tweet your questions, comments, whatever you want to tweet. These will be picked up by our colleague Bradley Barlow here at the front, who will address some of those questions to our speakers later. And finally, on a very bright note, there is a reception after the event, which is open to all. So you're very welcome to join the speakers and to discuss the themes that will be opened up during the talks. So we'll start with Conor, who will introduce the book in some 15, 20 minutes, and then our discussants will present their comments, and then we'll open up the discussion to the audience. Thank you very much. Conor.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Milos. That was a wonderful introduction with one omission, which is that there is also an opportunity, having enjoyed this free event, and the free drinks that will follow it. And it's not our fault we've ordered for 42 people. The free drinks that will follow it. There will also be an opportunity to wander, if you're not socialising effectively, in the direction of the bookstall, where you will find one book available for sale. Now, this book
I'm not using up my 15 minutes with this name.
This book, this book grew out of a cover. I had the idea for the cover, and then I wrote the book. And I can't remember, Oxford are here, I can't remember which beach we eventually settled on. But the flag on the web version of this book is much smaller. And my vision was of a giant beach and the little flag. And I'll end by coming back to the beach. And I want to talk about the book, obviously, and but I also want to acknowledge some things that have happened since the book. Oxford were amazing with this book, and I've got a foreword in it, which is post the referendum on the 23rd of June. And that's amazing publishing speed. And so I can't but acknowledge that when we chose the title, we put it in. And we've also had, of course, we've also had the election of Donald Trump. So these are really, really big events in our field. And I think I want to reflect on both of those as well. And the way I want to do it in my 15 or so minutes is I want to think a little bit with you about what human rights in the European context entails. Because when you look at the documentation that reflects a human rights perspective or asserts a human rights approach, it's about not one, not two, but three things. Now, I don't say this about global human rights, but in the European context, human rights entails a commitment to representative democracy. And human rights entails a commitment to legality or the rule of law. These are key parts of human rights. Now, of course, human rights is about equality of esteem. It's about dignity. Of course it is. But that is a part of it. That is one of the essential elements. And the other two are there as well. And it's worth reflecting on that because what the Brexit vote has done, more on the human rights proper, equality of esteem in a moment, is completely, in a very important way, challenge the first two of those parts of our human rights arrangement. And I want to just spend a second reflecting on why that might be. The idea of parliamentary involvement in the decision is regarded as wild heresy by persons committed to the departure of the United Kingdom from the European Union. And the people who suggest that it might happen are attacked and abused for asserting parliamentary democracy. And the courts, whose job it is to work out what the law requires, courts that have been respected by the Bush presidency, by Margaret Thatcher, by every political actor of seriousness, are regarded as a place that is engaged in subversive activity, in receiving arguments about the legality of a governmental decision to nullify, in what is claimed to be an irreversible manner, the intention to depart the European Union. Enemies of the people. Betrayal. Now, these are important parts of the human rights story, which need to be understood as part of it as well as part of something larger. And they appear crazy, irrational, at first glance, especially to people, perhaps to people, who think that the referendum was about bringing back control, about democratic success. But actually, as we now see, and when we see these previously failed middle-aged white men who are suddenly enjoying their moment in the sun, obscure former leaders of failed political entities, never off the Today programme. When we see them in action, we see the true nature of the Brexit event, which is that it is a movement driven above all, above democracy, above the rule of law, human rights in a moment, by a desire to get out of Europe
and everything else is purely instrumental. And this is the modern version of the fantasy that I addressed. You see glimpses of it. A good guide to the delusions is Mr. Fox, who, because he was briefly a doctor, is required by people to call himself Dr. Fox. I think we need to say also a distinguished author. He's insisting the department read his book. When he talked about why Britain cannot return to the 19th century, the glories of the 19th century, unaware that this was rooted in slavery and imperial oppression. When we see the fetishization of the Magna Carta, we see glimpses of the same drive that is underpinning this surge. We see also the hounding of what are called the fat cats, the Mrs. May's unfortunate phrase, the citizens of nowhere, the cherishing of what are called the jams. What is this about? It's about wresting control as a negative, getting away from Europe. And that's not a rational basis for making decisions or policy. It's not a rational basis for reasons that Mr. Johnson, who is, I think, still Foreign Secretary, he's now being asked to wear a little badge when he's speaking, it's me, in which case he's an enjoyable media personality with Trump-like hair, or I'm the Foreign Secretary, in which case he puts his head down and reads a script. He said of Saudi Arabia, there are politicians who are twisting and abusing religion and different strains of the same religion in order to further their own political objectives. Substitute the word nationalism for religion, and he has precisely described himself. I think that we are living, and I think there's a whole issue here about the role of academics. We are living in a revolutionary moment. Now, what is a revolutionary moment? I believe a revolutionary moment is when decisions are taken regardless of economic, institutional, social, or cultural consequences. Nobody, when there is a French Revolution or an Irish Revolution or a Soviet Revolution, is thinking about the economic returns or the social returns. It's the equivalent here. The Brexiteer addiction to getting out of Europe bears no defiance on the basis of any data. That's why the Michael Gove point about experts was very important. And what we must prepare for is, as this fantasy collides with fact, the blame of others will be allocated. There have been two indications of this. Liam Fox has already begun to blame British business people for their sloppy efforts. So in 5 or 6 years, I guarantee he'll be saying it would have been a brilliant success had it not been for the fat English businessmen who spend too much time drinking after golf. It'll be their fault. At the moment, the current fault is the European officials who are being extremely rude and not nearly as nice as they ought to be. This is what happens when ideological revolution fails. You blame other people. In the end, Hitler, as we know from Ian Kershaw's brilliant biography, ended up demanding that the blinds be pulled down on the trains because he blamed the German people for the catastrophe of World War II. If they'd been a different people, it would have been fine. I predict in 10 years there'll be blame of the British people for not having risen to the challenge of Brexit. Now, so don't expect any humble pie anytime soon from these people. Where does human rights fit? Proper, equality of esteem. Genuine belief that we are, as a bunch of people, sharing a geographic space in it together. Well, we have some indicators. It's very revealing the other day that we learned that the current Prime Minister, as Home Secretary, sought to disadvantage the children of illegal immigrants in schools. It's got a haunting echo with Marie Le Pen's statement today, which I think may dish her, I don't know, I'm perpetually wrong, I'm perpetually optimistic, that the children of immigrants shouldn't be given free education. Immigrants, not illegal immigrants, immigrants in France. This may be a step too far. Punishing children for the existence of their parents, in Le Pen's case, for alleged wrongdoing in Theresa May's case is an absolutely technically clear flouting of equality of esteem. The indication by Amber Rudd, as Home Secretary, that she wanted to publish these lists of foreigners in businesses is, to anybody who knows their history, a preliminary to actions. Flushing out people is the first thing you do. In my opinion, absolutely clear acknowledgement that difference is what matters here, and the use of EU citizens as bargaining chips in a negotiation with the European Union over the deal that will be done on Brexit. Instrumentalising European citizens in this country is a shocking example of an explicit rejection of equality. Explicit. Now, some years ago I wrote a book which coined a term, neo-democracy, where people cover up their abuse of human rights behind a veneer of consistency. But things have moved so fast in our culture that the veneer is falling away, and that it's now sort of okay to say that we'll punish innocent people to warn others. And Trump is a wild example of the danger of how far it can go. Now, we have here two, dare I say it, in this place, it doesn't have the insulting ring it does elsewhere, experts. Experts. And it's very important that universities stand up for expertise. We should be counter-revolutionaries for truth, for data, and for expertise, quite independent of your views on Brexit. You should be absolutely rigorous in your belief that facts matter. We have people here who know a lot about this. On the European Union, I'll say briefly this, and we had interesting evidence of it today. The EU idea was the market, of course, but tempered by the social chapter. So it represents an effort to combine the liberty of those with money and opportunity with the freedoms of others who are less well off. The social chapter, it was, I think, conceived of by Jacques Delors. We saw yesterday John Whittingdale and Michael Gove asking the CBI to send them a list of regulations that can be set aside post-Brexit. And we see in the sights of the authorities maternity rights. We see the head of the Institute of Directors already talking about the Americanization of maternity rights. We see workers' rights in the firing line. We see, of course, the environmental advances, clean beaches, water, safety and so on in the firing line. One of the peculiarities of that billionaire who thought that he could run London and afterwards proved he couldn't even run Richmond is that he opposed Heathrow and supported departure from the European Union without seeming to have made the connection that it was environmental standards at EU level that made the Heathrow expansion impossible. Now, maybe he's not sufficiently well educated to make the connection, or maybe, because he, maybe he is an ideological, a revolutionary, he doesn't care, out at all costs. Now, we hear our friend, the parliamentarian fellow at the Institute of Public Affairs, David Davis, talk about how we should calm down and the rights will be preserved and so on. But look at their so-called Great Reform Act. These revolutionaries don't care at all about Parliament. They want ministerial regulation to set aside the EU regulations at the drop of a ministerial hat without any parliamentary accountability at all. That's taking back control. And they will do it in secret at the behest of corporate power, which will gradually, the CBI has already been invited to do it, which will gradually set aside these impediments to profit. And the model they've got is the American model. Now, America's opposite. Those who think that the government won't do it, they have the goodwill of their people at stake. They'll care. They know about the problem of child obesity. They know how to solve it. Every single person who knows about it says how you should solve it. They were committed to a policy to reduce child obesity. There's no European dimension at all, and they couldn't pull it off. If you remember last summer, they couldn't pull it off. They couldn't even do the simplest thing to reduce child obesity under the pressure from the sugar lobby. How do we expect them to resist the pressure of the anti-environment corporate lobbies, the people who are furious about, in particular, maternity leave and the costs of health and safety gone mad. It'll be open season. It'll be open season. Now, the book, when it was written, it was about the Human Rights Act, and I want to say something about that by way of relatively close to the end here. The attack, the word relatively is doing a lot of work there. I know my chair's getting a bit worried. The attack on the Human Rights Act began in mid-noughties, really, and it was initiated by this Hearst case, this dreadful, dreadful guy, and a European Court of Human Rights decision on prisoner voting. But it was at the time, it was a double proxy for the real enemy. The real enemy was the European Union. And it was a double proxy because nobody at the time thought you could take on the European Union. It's amazing how quickly politics changes. But we could take on the European Convention on Human Rights. Well, we don't want to do that. So let's go for the Human Rights Act. Let's kick the guy in the playground who's the smallest guy in the playground. And so it became a kind of proxy attack on Europe because it had the European Convention in its schedule and so on. I see today the Attorney General, the chap who so startled everybody in the Supreme Court case, in not necessarily an ideal way. I see the Attorney General has said today in parliamentary answers that they're still committed to a Bill of Rights for Britain, they're still committed to reform on the Human Rights Act, but the poor old attorney says, in answer to Mr. Peter Bone, a leading ideologue, the government is certainly committed to doing something about that. That's the European human rights thing. And then poor old Attorney General, he will have noticed that we have a few other things on our plate at the moment. I think we will have to resolve those before we can resolve the matters to which he refers. Poor thing. He must be in bad form. So it probably isn't going to happen immediately, but the assault on the human rights thing has to happen and will happen. It will happen. First of all, the logic of using European citizens as a bargaining tool is that you have to make it possible to throw them out. At the moment, some guy's written a blog saying he can throw Europeans out under the Human Rights Act. I'm not absolutely certain he's totally right, but it seems to me, in order to make the threat real, you have to be able to do it, and in law at the moment you can't. So I think there's going to be pressure there as the negotiating bites to be able to say, make the domestic law fit for expulsion. The media have long hated the Human Rights Act and really want to get rid of it for commercial reasons. They love invading privacy, they don't like being constrained, and they lose no opportunity to diss it because it fits with their populist agenda. Three, the military have become very cross about the controls that the Human Rights Act imposes on their people. And their people, I mean their soldiers. The bullied soldiers, the soldiers killed because of inadequate equipment, and also, of course, the torture and inhuman degrading treatment and killing of individuals in places like, not the battlefield, hotels, in places which are completely outside the battlefield. The military have become a very strong lead. Military leaders, of course, I don't mean the actual soldiers, who might benefit from the constraints on bullying and so on that might otherwise go unnoticed, have become big enemies. And they have an ally in the Secretary of State for Defence. And also, more importantly, I think, events. I think it's not just the media, the army, and the bargaining tool, events. If we had another abracadabra, I think there'd be a repeal of the Human Rights Act. If we had another strong case where the media became hysterical about somebody who was kind of a potentially subversive person, I think we'd have. So I think it's going to come. Minot said I'm a big defender of the Human Rights Act. I was, of course, initially a sceptic on the Human Rights Act. This is literally winding down, literally winding down. We live apart from the sort of quota thing that comes a bit later on, the rhetorical thing, and then a long reading from the book. But I think defending the Human Rights Act now, and the final chapter is something like Keep the Human Rights Act or something, is not just anymore about the Human Rights Act. You know, you have to see what's going on around you and change with what's going on around you. It's actually about something else. Post-Trump, post-Farage, with Le Pen in the background, It's a line in the sand. It has to be a line in the sand. Thus far and no further. We saw a rather dramatic and wonderful one in Austria. Thus far and no further. We need to hold the line on social democratic values, on equality of esteem, a commitment to representative government and legality. And maybe it'll work, but the task we have is we need to prove that social democracy wasn't just something we had to protect us from communism during the Cold War. We have to show that social democracy, of which the human rights thing is an important part, in my opinion, is more than simply a defensive shield against a communism now gone. And we can win. I said I'd end with beaches. This is how I end the preface to the book. It's only about four lines. The Human Rights Act may yet survive. The UK's membership of the European Union might even as well. After the Roman Empire had converted to Christianity, one empire stood out against the change, seeking to turn back the clock to the old pagan ways. Julian lasted just 3 years, and Christianity came back stronger than ever. Maybe, as Prime Minister, one or other of the Brexiteers or near-Brexiteers is fated to play the role of King Canute, whose wisdom in showing that he could not resist the tides has long been misunderstood as stupidity. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I very much look forward to the longer reading from the book later. Well, we might have to bring the wine through to the lecture theatre. All five bottles. Right. We'll move on to our discussants. Steve Pearce. Oh, God.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you very much for inviting me and giving me the opportunity to discuss the book and to discuss the broader topic of human rights after Brexit. It's lovely to see so many of you here, of course. I imagine that those of you who were advising the government on Brexit now have some extra time on your hands after some of Boris's policy changes. Well, first of all, this is an excellent book in many ways. It has a thorough grasp of detail. It makes the case for the Human Rights Act in social, political, and historic context, all interwoven throughout the book. It has a command of the whole of the legal issues, but then also an understanding and an explanation of the importance of these cases to the individuals who received a remedy for some terrible abuse or events that they'd suffered as a result of being able to invoke the Act. What it does particularly well is that it examines and debunks the mythology relating to the history of the common law on human rights. As the book points out, yes, there is some common law, which historic common law, which supports human rights. So the Salvation Army had the right to march joylessly to demand that people suffered grinding poverty with tedious sobriety. But there were many other people who couldn't march, and many people who had wrongful convictions sometimes turned into wrongful executions. And there would have been more wrongful executions, of course, of particularly Irish people if we hadn't ended the death penalty when we did in the 1960s. And it also examines and debunks, say, the constitutional myths, you could call them, concerning excessive judicial power under the Act as compared to traditional parliamentary sovereignty, and points out how the Act does constrain the role of the judges and does retain parliamentary sovereignty, preventing judges from setting aside acts of parliament. Now, in fact, you could already argue from the basis of the book that the Human Rights Act is already, as it were, patriotic enough. It's already British enough. It even makes a comparison in the book with Canada and New Zealand, some of the Brexiteers' favourite Commonwealth countries, and the way that they deal with the human rights issues and balance them with parliamentary sovereignty. You could even say that the same thing to an extent about the ECHR, as the book points out. There was a significant British influence on the drafting of the convention. The two of them together, the domestic and international protection system, are, you could say, so British that they're already red, white and blue, and that you could build a patriotic gong so loud that even Pavlov's bulldogs would salivate when you mentioned either of them. But however, of course, that's not the position we're in. The public perception of what the Act is and what the Act does is already highly entrenched, and I'll come back to that problem after I talk about the Brexit context of human rights. And this has two elements, the substantive dimension, you could call it, and the political advocacy dimension. So by the substantive dimension, what does Brexit mean for human rights? Well, EU law has an impact on human rights protections, briefly discussed in the book, but to add to that, it has an impact on human rights protection if a particular human rights dispute can be linked back to EU law, as you most often would find in cases like asylum, discrimination law, data protection, or some employment law cases. If you can find that link, you can invoke ECHR-related rights and some additional human rights referred to in the EU Charter of Rights, and they have additional legal effect in a number of cases decided by the ECJ and the British courts. Lower courts can set aside national law, and so can even higher courts, obviously, set aside acts of Parliament in a way that isn't possible under the Human Rights Act. So post-Brexit, how much of that will survive? Well, that will come down to the Great Repeal Act that Connor's already mentioned. And as the whole ex-EU law effect in our country is going to be dependent on what happens in that battle over the Great Repeal Act. Now, I hope that the corpse of the Labour Party will reanimate in time for that debate and to play sufficient influence that with enough defecting Tories and so on, there can be constraints upon what the government plans are. There are going to be some fundamental questions there. Connor has already touched on the ease which ministers are going to ask for to repeal ex-EU law. And additionally, there are going to be questions about, do you continue to follow ECJ case law? Is the EU Charter relevant at all to the interpretation of ex-EU law in the UK after Brexit? What happens if the legislation changes? What's the legal effect of that ex-EU law? Is it an ordinary act of Parliament? Is it at least a constitutional statute? Whatever that might mean. So those are all important questions which we'll have to focus on, I think, very soon when the Great Repeal Act reaches us. But there's a political dimension as well, a political battle that we're going to have, and I'm sure Connor's correct that when he says, in effect, the Brexiteers aren't going to feel full after Brexit is accomplished. They're still going to be hungry, and they'll doubtlessly look to the Human Rights Act as their next snack. So, yes, there are similarities between the Human Rights Act and the Brexit issue. There are some substantive overlap. There are some differences. Politically, I think the big difference is that, of course, there isn't a referendum. The dynamics are quite different if you don't have a referendum, although we might, who knows, end up going into the next election with some party promising one. We'll see what happens if that's the case. Now, in the broader debate, I think there are some important political similarities. There is, of course, this broader historical context that underpins them both. We're both, in both cases, talking about sort of removing a European element to our constitution, to our law, and sort of going back to something else. As I would describe it as a situation where, you know, Britain has lost its post-war role but cannot refound its empire. So what does that leave us with in those circumstances beyond the sort of loud debates that we're having now? We can't recreate the situation as it was in the 1950s or 70s. Now, towards the end, there's an interesting discussion. Towards the end of the book, there's an interesting discussion of what might happen. It is conceivable, and I agree it's conceivable, that Britain could have its own replacement for the Human Rights Act, which builds on the common law and which has a decent degree of human rights protection. It's conceivable in the same way that sort of liberal Labour's vision of a Britain without hate crime and trading with the world and sort of rationally going about post-Brexit business was conceivable, but clearly it does not seem to be happening. So is this possible? Could, in effect, we have our human rights cake and eat it too? Well, I think it is unlikely in the current context. First of all, because we already know what the government is planning, and Michael Gove, when he was the Justice Minister, said something about it, and he gave some indication that the idea is basically to exclude, when we redraft the Act, have a new British Bill of Rights. The idea would be to exclude anyone who was remotely unpopular, like criminals and foreigners and so on. I'm sure there's a long list, tabloids will add to that, while in return giving a kind of constitutional bung to tabloid newspapers, some kind of extra protection for their freedom of expression, which would satisfy them to go along with it. That's one reason. Why? The other reason why is the way our post-Brexit debate has gone. Effectively, for the last 6 months, we've had one side saying, we won, shut up, and the other side saying, we won't, you lied. And that has, you know, elaborations of that, you know, which devolve into abuse. Of course, punctuated by political murder and lots of threats and hints that there might be more to come. And with frequent refrains from a large part of our government and media showing a visceral contempt for parliamentary democracy and the rule of law. This isn't a great context to start rationally thinking about a sort of theoretical possibility of a homegrown British Bill of Rights which would have any real value to it. Well, my final point then about our post-Brexit situation is the way in which we argue about human rights. Now, of course, all of us who are involved in teaching and writing on human rights law or practice human rights law have to think in detail. We have to explain to students what the substantive rights are, what the detailed deadlines are, so that they can make an application in time in a way that the Home Office maybe doesn't understand in some cases. But so we have to have that kind of detailed knowledge. All of us do, and it's certainly displayed in the book, and many of us try and get into that level of detail with our students. And, you know, in my case, I've been called forensic so many times that I should probably have a CSI spin-off that explains that. Well, of course, we do have to do that. But I think there's a risk in being too detailed that people just don't listen. And there's also a risk in being too defensive. And there's excellent arguments in Connor's book pointing out, yes, that, as I said, that parliamentary sovereignty is protected. The judges can't overturn laws. But in a way that, when I read those parts, it reminded me of the referendum debate, when I kept saying, oh, but we can veto that. Or, oh, no, the EU laws aren't adopted by unelected Eurocrats. Now, all that's true, and everything that Connor says is true. But if you spend your whole time, I think, getting defensive about it, I think you miss the opportunity to make a positive case, which is probably what the Remain side particularly failed to do. So let me conclude by suggesting the sort of positive case that ought to be made for the Human Rights Act. And it's there in the substance of the cases. Of course, some claimants are hard to love, but then there are those with which I think a lot of British people can have sympathy. So, you know, what about the thalidomide babies whose you know, parents couldn't argue about medical negligence and wrongdoing? What about the gay man kicked out of his home as soon as his lifelong partner died and who wouldn't have been able to stay in his flat he stayed in for years without being able to invoke the Human Rights Act? What about vulnerable elderly people left in their own filth because there's no way, wasn't sufficient way except for the Human Rights Act to challenge the level of care which they're receiving? What about children beaten so badly that they need medical attention and the argument that that was abuse that was going so far as to breach Article 3 of the ECHR? What about bereaved family members trying to seek justice and trying to find out what happened when their loved one died? So those are just a few of the many people who are able to claim human rights in this country, who have been able to claim them because of the Human Rights Act or because of the ECHR before it. Those are the people whose lives we should be thinking about, whose stories we should be telling when we argue about the importance of the Human Rights Act. And I think Connor does a good job of telling that, but we should all focus on those sorts of debates when the time comes, as it will, that we have to stand up and defend the Act. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Shauna Douglas-Scott.
Well, thank you very much, Connor and the LSE, for inviting me here this evening. I'm afraid this wouldn't pass BBC neutrality, because I'm going to go on and say I think this is a wonderful book, and a huge amount of people you have assembled here today are a sign of the esteem in which you are held, Connor. And it is a wonderful book, and even if you haven't studied the Human Rights Act, it's a wonderful introduction to it. There are some of the clearest explanations of those tricky, rather technical sections of the Human Rights Act, sections 2, 3, and 4. I'm going to give it to my students to read, because it's wonderful, it's really, really clear. But I'm not going to talk about technical issues tonight, and I'm not going to talk about section 2, 3, 4, or anything else. I'm going to continue with the theme that's already been picked up by Connor and by Steve, and I'm going to talk a little bit about this connection between Human Rights Act and Brexit, because when you wrote the book, I'm sure it wasn't completely obvious this is what was going to happen, but now this is where we are. And I think that there is this really obvious connection between the monstering of the Human Rights Act. Connor, you talk very much in terms of fantasies, but you also mention the monstering of this. And that's also what we see in the context of Brexit. And you in the book, Connor, give examples of monstering of human rights and the fact that the press in particular pick up on certain doubtless not very worthy individuals as monsters. But this is what has happened in the case of Brexit. To the extent that the British people have been so put off by the EU that they voted en masse to leave it and to give up their EU citizenship. And what was it that the British people were rejecting when they voted to give up EU citizenship and leave the EU? Well, they were very much voting to get rid of rights, because this is what EU citizenship is about, and this is what UK nationality and citizenship is not about. It's not about rights. EU citizenship is about rights. And in that sense, I think it's a bit alien for Brits. British nationality, British citizenship, for so long has been conceived in terms of subjecthood. One is a subject of Her Majesty. But along comes EU citizenship, and you have these rights to freedom of movement, rights to reside, rights to work, and then these workers' rights that have come along with it, that it may well be we will see the end of, because some of them will be very easy to get rid of through the Great Repeal Bill and through Henry VIII clauses and other very undemocratic means. So there is this monstering going on. And I think it's very interesting to look a little bit behind this. My colleague at Queen Mary, Elspeth Guild, recently gave an inaugural lecture. And in her inaugural lecture, she talked a bit about citizenship and EU citizenship. And she looked at the example of St. George and the dragon. St. George, as you will know, is the patron saint of England. That part of the UK whose people were decisive in the referendum and determining the outcome of the referendum. St. George is normally portrayed as slaying a dragon, the monster killer, the monstrous dragon, which has been the cause of so much suffering to the people, the English. In the iconography of the Brexit campaign, the EU was presented as a truly monstrous entity, sucking out British state sovereignty from the British polity, enslaving the British people in foreign laws. So the vote to leave is presented as a vote for liberty and independence, take back control. And experts who disagreed with this deride it, sometimes even in... We have colleagues who have been actually in physical danger, who have been warned that they cannot go around without a police escort as a result. And, of course, this is about rights. And the Human Rights Act will be very important. I'm surprised that it hasn't surfaced more already in this context of leaving the EU and EU citizenship, because there are definite issues under Article 8, and I think there are property rights at issue. And maybe because the business community and City UK will be involved, there are definitely important property rights that are in danger of being violated with Brexit. Now, Connor, in your book, you talk a little bit about the fact that it's not just politicians and the press who threaten, undermine, or monster the Human Rights Act, things European. You talk a little bit about certain other academics as well. Academics, some of them writing for the Judicial Power Project, who pay homage to a rather mythical idea of human rights in Britain in an earlier era. The common law as it was. Even if this common law wasn't replete with liberty, and in fact it contained some rather illiberal decisions. In this way, I think one might be reminded of the situation in the United States, where there have been certain members of the Supreme Court, Antonin Scalia comes to mind, who have looked with great favour at an ideal of the, or an idea of the US Constitution. But the US Constitution in the 18th century, when it was white and male, an originalist version of it. And of course, President-elect Trump will have a wonderful chance to fill the Supreme Court now with people who believe in the same way. Coming back, though, to this idea of rights and the rights that we stand to lose, either through repeal of the Human Rights Act or through Brexit, I find it very interesting that rights have surfaced so much in the Miller case being decided in the Supreme Court. And rightly so, because rights are what we stand to lose when the UK leaves the EU. And in a sense, this is constitutional law 101, that Parliament cannot take away, that the government cannot take away rights. If there is legislation, if there are rights that people have in UK law, the government, by the exercise of the prerogative, cannot take those rights away. There must be parliamentary legislation. That is a key issue in the Miller case. But I find it interesting that the argument that is coming back is that, these are the wrong kind of rights. Why are they the wrong kind of rights? Well, because they're not proper British statutory rights. They come from EU law, and the European Communities Act is just a conduit for them. They are not protected in UK law. And this has been a really, really important argument in the Miller case, and I think it says something about the way that we perceive, the way we understand those rights that we have coming from the European Convention and coming from the European Union. They're not really British. Therefore, we can't protect them according to the well-versed, understood ways of the British Constitution. Therefore, the case must be lost. I just want to finish, Connor, by asking a couple of questions, really, of you, which, of course, you are free to completely disregard. But they relate to the end chapters of your book, where there was a certain amount of optimism. My first question relates to wasn't the last chapter, but coming to the end on repeal, where you write that the problem when political fantasy collides with legal facts is that fantasy can never win. In a system that values the rule of law, the courtroom is a place of reason, with rational argument taking pride of place over rhetoric. And you give the Leveson inquiry as an example. But is this really so? How do we square this with the enemies of the people that we see in the Daily Mail, which you have already mentioned? Or what I've read on the Judicial Power website, which says that the legal proceedings underway, namely Miller, are dangerous. The simple act of hearing the challenges at all risks fueling this perception that the courts are perceived to be helping to frustrate Brexit. Note, this is a reference just to a perception But the courts have been at pains in this case to make clear they are not in any way trying to block Brexit. And this has been made clear by the government as well in their submissions and their statements outside of court. But nonetheless, just the perception that a court is hearing a case that some people may think of in this way is seen as being undesirable. So can we really, really have faith in reason if this is what we are seeing going on right now? Can it be that reason, that sustained legal argument, can win out over these fantasies? And it doesn't help that the Lord Chancellor doesn't rush to defend the judiciary against vicious attacks that it received in the press, except too little and too late. And the second question I have concerns what you write about the Human Rights Act and our values, that somehow particular values are there enshrined in the Human Rights Act. I think the problem is, though, that for so many people in Britain, they don't share those values, they don't feel that way. And how could that be the case when for so, so long, the press, the government, everybody has been deriding things European? And it goes back much longer than that. Linda Colley, who I think is a professor here at the LSE, writing in a wonderful book about Britons, talking about what it is that forged the identity of the British in the 18th and 19th century, sets out certain key factors, the monarchy, Protestantism, also wars against Europe. And even now, we see this rhetoric going back to the French, the Frogs, the Germans. When there is no attempt made to counteract that, how can there be instilled in the British a desire to feel European, a European identity, an embrace of things European as something worthwhile? I think that is a very real problem. So those are two, actually, of several questions that I had when I came to the end of your book, and I'm not going to go on and mention any more. We can maybe talk about that later, and of course you don't have to respond in any way. But I suppose it is just a question a little bit about this optimism at the end. I don't feel quite so optimistic. And a couple of years ago, in the context of some debate, I'm not quite sure when the then Prime Minister David Cameron and Theresa May were talking about repealing the Human Rights Act and replacing it with the British Bill of Rights, the Liberal Democrats then in government were protective of the Human Rights Act. And Nick Clegg, Deputy Prime Minister, said the Human Rights Act is here to stay. Well, I note that the Liberal Democrats have now gone. Will the Human Rights Act remain? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Conor will exercise his right to reply very briefly to those two questions that Shauna put to him, and then we'll open up the discussion.
Yeah, very, very briefly, because I think we want to have a discussion. But on legal argument, I think the government will probably accept the ruling, whatever it is. And the Secretary of State for leaving the European Union, David Davis, was one of the few people who actually said, apropos the Miller case earlier, we need to respect the judgment. So we have not yet got to the point where there is a disregard of judgments, and that seems to me quite important. On the purely emotional level of seeing rational argument, where there is a discussion rooted in data, has made me much more keen on the legal process than before. And the various things I hated about the legal process, in particular its elite insulation from politics, is now proving in a weird way to be a strength. They don't need to get on with the Prime Minister. You know, they go back to their own little clubs and they meet themselves and they give each other solidarity. And I think actually solidarity is the answer also to the second question. The way Steve made a brilliant, impassioned plea for the Human Rights Act at the end, and using Adams Wagner's idea of the monstering of human rights and how we take it on. But as I said in this room after the referendum at about 3 a.m, 30 years of negative publicity about the European Union cannot be undone in 3 months. And it's the same with the Human Rights Act. But we begin again. And the young people of Forest, the schools mainly, the ordinary schools, in inverted commas, the progressive state schools, are excellent. that you cannot build a society based on the illiberalism that is being promoted by these people. So we will, in the end, I think, win. We have to keep these threads of optimism present. Now, the Lib Dems are not gone. They've just won Richmond, you know? Yeah. That is, I see Baroness Ludford there. Is she there? Is that here? That's I can right. recognise her here, here. Yeah, there she goes again. Absolutely. Give the Lib Dems an inch and they take a mile, but they deserve a little bit of a treat here.
It seems like they're all here.
They're not gone. They're not gone. And one of the, watch the by-elections in councils and watch the emergence, possibly, of a progressive alliance. One thing that I'm tempted, Sarah, you're here. Supposing the Lib Dems fought the election, if there were a general election, on a single issue, a new referendum, and then a fresh election. And if there were progressive people did not fight against them, which Labour oughtn't have done, in my opinion, in Richmond. So they're not finished, and life isn't over till it's over. But we mustn't give in without a fight. We mustn't give in without a fight. And therefore, corporations are important. This thing we used to laugh at about social responsibility, corporations might make it impossible for Trump to destroy the planet. If they've bought in to the achievements of the Obama period, who wants to have on their CV they wreck the planet to make a bit more for their shareholders? Will shareholders want to wreck the planet? So it's important to keep playing where we can and see off the people who think knowledge and expertise is to be derided.
Conal, thank you very much. Right, so your questions, let me say a couple of things. When you ask a question, please wait for the microphone to come to you. We've got a lovely, hard-working stewards who will bring a microphone to you. If you could please introduce yourselves and please keep it as brief as possible. I don't want to interfere with your right to free speech. I just want to enhance your right to precision. Okay, so questions. Any takers? The gentleman in the white shirt there? Here, in the middle. I'll group the questions. I'll take three. So please put your hands up if you want to ask more questions. But please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Rory from UCD, studying Masters in Human Rights. I just wanted to know your... just a comment on the impact a repeal of the Human Rights Act will have on Northern Ireland and its break in terms of courts with the ECHR, although there will still be able to claims be made to the ECHR and the impact on Northern Ireland.
Okay, thank you very much. The gentleman in the black top and the glasses.
Thank you very much. Michael Olatokun from the Bingham Centre for the Rule of Law. Very recently, I was on a programme working with ministers and parliamentarians in a Commonwealth jurisdiction that I will not name. But they have quite a few issues with pluralism and observance of many human rights principles. And I found that in working with them on this project, broaching concepts like making your democracy look like the mother of all parliaments, which they still had this really weird fetishization for, and observance of the rule of law as a set of principles were easier conversations to broach than talking about human rights per se and equality of esteem. So I guess my question is, as human rights activists and people trying to promote this stuff, are there other hooks which are better and more useful for preserving human rights than human rights itself?
And Heather. But the, just the row in front.
Hi. So I want to ask about the paradox of the Human Rights Act. So the fact that it's meant to be universal, but then the fact that it's so technical kind of pushes people away from fighting for it. So I just want to ask, how would you say, like, how do we make people support the Human Rights Act and kind of take away that kind of, I guess, elitist kind of veneer to it? Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, should I go first? Rory, Northern Ireland, I think there's been some good work already done. It's really quite a serious thing, and you've asked about the human rights thing, but more generally. Essentially, the part of the settlement in Northern Ireland, which incorporated a number of agreements, acknowledged the role of human rights and the implementation of human rights laws in Northern Ireland as an essential feature of the agreed conclusion of a very substantial period of civil disorder. Its importance, in my opinion, lies in it seeming to be a concession by the British government and, in inverted commas, a kind of win for the Republican movement. And the Republican movement, which you may remember fought a 30-year struggle to win a united Ireland, failed. And they failed lamentably. But they had to bring the thing to an end in a way that they felt could respect themselves. And human rights became part of that, and the protection of human rights became part of that. And the Irish government and the Irish people in the Republic of Ireland were tied into it, and part of this was enactment of human rights laws. The Irish Republic, though it had a written constitution with guaranteed rights, did it in 2003, and the British resiling from their commitment would be a very serious matter. This is another example of what I called in my talk the revolutionary moment. It's so important nobody gives a damn about international obligations. And it's the same with the security in Ireland. It's an astonishing thing that a former chancellor who lives in France, who denies climate change and is in favour of Brexit, should have said that the solution for Ireland is to rejoin the United Kingdom. Rejoin the United Kingdom. And others have said that the job of Ireland is to act as the gatekeepers to the United Kingdom by policing its own ports. This is the fantasy of men of a certain age who've been brought up in school to believe that they have an inherent superiority. And it was on display, lamentably, in India, on a so-called prime ministerial tour, which I gather was a complete embarrassment. So it's shocking, and Ireland may pay a price, though Ireland's coping with it extremely well, in my opinion, at the moment, showing real leadership. It's a very interesting one, Michael, about activism. Some years ago, I was asked at a lecture I gave here in LSE about why do you always use the language of human rights, you know? And I am sort of Rortian on this. If you can find a better language to capture the essence of fairness and equality of esteem, then I will use it, you know. And human rights has captured something, and I think this is the unnamed speaker paradox question answered as well. It captures a variety of levels of engagement in society. It can be one, a legal protection for people, which is very important. We've talked a lot about that here. It can be the underpinning of a social movement. So it's the language behind which an energetic reimagination of the entitlements of people is pursued, indigenous peoples, people with disabilities, etc. And it can be a way in which people can assert a liberation from oppression, not by relying on the goodwill of others, but by compassion, but by asserting an entitlement rooted in their humanity to things that others say they should only have as a result of the largesse of the powerful. So these are very advantageous layers of meaning to human rights, but there is, of course, a tension between them. But however the tension may be, the success of a term lies in being able successfully to manage the various tensions and be part legal protection, part social movement, and part egalitarian push.
Yes, I'll answer two of those points. On Northern Ireland, and I would add Scotland, where there might also be an argument about the Scotland Act and human rights protection, what the Supreme Court says in the current litigation on Brexit may be relevant, even though it's not explicitly on Human Rights Act, of course, because it is also about the Scotland Act in general, how it fits in, and the Sewell Convention, how it fits in with within the British Constitution more broadly, and the Good Friday Agreement, how it more generally fits in within the British Constitution. So we may have some indication already. On the question of the human rights argument being too technical, I tried to address that at the end when I said that we should be more passionate about it, and you know, without distorting facts, just to look at the cases where people who were in great need, who were terribly vulnerable, who needed help, got it because of the Human Rights Act or the ECHR. And the phrase, of course, I should have used is constitutional patriotism. I mean, that's what we're missing in this debate. That's what Germans have about their basic law, and why perhaps one of the reasons why you have a sort of it's one of the places in Europe where there's the least sign of a populist wave happening, because you have that identification with the rights entrenched in the basic law as part of the system. And of course, in the United States, what's going to be a big feature of the resistance to Trump is the fact that you have these highly entrenched constitutional rights, which he's obviously this is going to put a certain number of people on the Supreme Court, but he's going to have to wait for more people to die to put more than one on, and So in the meantime, of course, there are lower courts and it's a highly decentralized country, the states, the cities, all sorts of things can happen to frustrate a lot of what he wants to do. So and in America as well, you have constitutional patriotism. Everyone in America knows what the First Amendment is about. Everybody knows what it means when you say, I'm taking the Fifth. Everybody has watched 100 times people read out a Supreme Court ruling in every cop show. They read out the Miranda warning that comes from a Supreme Court case. Now, some of those cases are controversial, like Roe v. Wade, which is obviously more divisive. But then some of them have, until very recently, become iconic as part of the development of the U.S. as it is today. And I'm thinking of school desegregation. You would have thought this argument was over when the racists were long gone, but there they are, some of them in the White House. But this is the means to fight back. It's not quite the same. The U.S. Supreme Court is and the U.S. Constitution is not the same as it was when it was just white men writing it and defining black people as not quite human in it, and the Supreme Court going along with that, causing a civil war. It's been changed since. And, of course, you have political development since as well as that. So it's not quite so easy to go back to rewind everything to that prior position.
Yeah. Yes, if I could say, starting off with the Northern Ireland point, I mean, one thing I like very much about your book, Connor, is the fact that you do remind us that human rights are for the whole of the United Kingdom. They're not just English. And I think this reform, a British Bill of Rights, has often been in danger of being an English Bill of Rights and taking on Magna Carta or habeas corpus, which aren't necessarily recognised or very familiar in other parts of the United Kingdom. I totally agree with what Steve said about the Miller case. It's been fascinating that there has been this time with the representations made from Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland, and much of that on rights as well. That's very important. It reminds us that Britain is a devolved country. It's not just one part of it. And I think that is hugely important. And if Human Rights Act reform repeal flounders, it will be partly because its repeal is just going to be unworkable in parts of the United Kingdom. Second point, human rights without human rights. How can the message be got across without maybe using the language of human rights? I can see why at times that might be thought to be necessary, but I think that there's also a current in Britain as well that resists human rights because it's seen again as a bit of an alien language. Sorry to come back to Miller again, but I thought a very interesting point was made by one of the advocates today for the UK government, who said, well, where there's no remedy, there can't be a right. And this is turning things round in the way they should not be turned round. This is going back to 19th century and Dicey and a rejection of human rights as something foreign and alien. So I would be careful about what we did with that. Finally, on the point of technical issues, I think perception is very important. And if human rights and human rights acts and bills of rights are seen as too technical, that does turn people off. I think that's one of the problems with the EU, where the Charter of Fundamental Rights has been seen by many people as just too technical. And it's very interesting that a lot of writings on EU fundamental rights focuses on things like jurisdiction. It never gets down to the substantive human rights issues itself. And then we lose sight of what human rights is about and why it's so important. So it is really important to focus on the rights themselves and not get too bogged down in the technicalities, which I'm afraid we lawyers sometimes tend to do.
Thank you, Shauna. More questions? The lady here at the front, here at the front, the blue in the blue top.
Thank you so much. A really, really fascinating discussion. But before I ask my question, just a little bit of feedback around the discussion. I think it would have been quite so. I completely agree with every single word that's been articulated today, but I think that's probably part of the problem a little. And it would have been quite helpful to have had a bit more of a varied perspective within the discussion group. But my question, I guess, is slightly related to that. I'd quite like to get a sense of your views around the Bill of Rights and whether it's a complete non-starter, whether actually, if you were to get a set of reassurances around it, it could possibly be a viable mechanism that could protect fundamental human rights if the Human Rights Act was scrapped.
Thank you. The gentleman, the blue top there. Glasses.
Well, there is no remedy. There can be no rights. What right have we to clean air? And what have those advocating human rights done in order to bring that about?
Any more questions this round?
I wasn't going to ask a question, Connor, because I'm the dissenting voice, but the lady has convinced me. Is it not fair to say that... Well, Tony Benn used to ask 5 questions, and one of the questions was, how do we get rid of you if we don't like you in a democracy? Is it not possible to say that the desire of the British people to basically exit the EU, and according to you, probably also exit the ECHR, and what we're seeing with Trump and what we're seeing across Europe, is in fact democracy in action? We may not like it. I'm part of the ruling elite just as much as everyone else in here, but it is what is happening. We are the ruling elite, and we don't like it when we lose, and that is what is happening right now. The tectonic plates are shifting, and we should recognize it and perhaps engage with it rather than do what we're doing at the moment, which is basically whine.
Connor.
Thanks. He didn't give his name, Robert Craig, and he's had... He's had multiple opportunities to develop his point, which he'll acknowledge. He'll acknowledge. And I think it's important because of what we heard in the front here, that I've also debated David Davis with human rights on multiple occasions here and had frequent people, Michael Pinto Duchinski here, who was the great, before Policy Exchange suddenly got all its money, the great leader of the anti-human rights brigade. So there's been plenty of opportunity for that. And also I have to say, I didn't know whether they would like the book. I didn't know. I asked 2 experts on European law, and for all I knew, they'd say it was completely defective. On the broader question, though, I don't think we are the BBC. Look at Question Time tonight and see who's on it. See how the centre has shifted. See how people like Ken Clark and Dominic Grieve and so on, who used to be on the right, are now way to the left. Do we want to join that? Do I want to join that? Not particularly. I don't want to be the person who argues with Michael Gove or Boris Johnson, as they shift politics towards lies and deceit, as they manipulate and manage affairs to promote their own interests. I don't think that's a normal debate, to be honest with you. And I think what's important is solidarity, and I'm delighted our colleagues here have enjoyed the book. I have debated on many occasions with opponents of my point of view. I relish it. I hope in the coming year to do more of it. But as to whether this should have been the case here, who would we have got? Who do you got? I don't know. They may have attacked the book, they may not. On a Bill of Rights for Britain, I am extremely doubtful that the government that has suggested lists of foreign workers being made public, that the Prime Minister who has suggested that we make it difficult for the children of illegal immigrants to go to school, would be a government that would produce a Bill of Rights for anything other than Britons. And a senior figure in the Conservative Party suggested as much in his contribution to a recent commission on a Bill of Rights for Britain, that there should be layers of rights and that the rights should be better if you're a British citizen and less good if you're not. And I think in the current climate that is what will be produced. And then following Robert's lead, no doubt it will be put to a referendum where the Europeans wouldn't be allowed to vote, as we all know, apart from the Irish. And then we'd be told by Robert that we're whining because we have second division rights, because the people have spoken. And that's my indirect way of answering Robert. There is a huge difference between saying you believe in representative democracy and saying you believe in popular democracy by referendum. A huge difference. And let's see whether they whine if there is a push for a second referendum as the reality of the change bites. I've whispered to Steve using my position as the person speaking here, that he can handle the clean air point. A bit unfair on him. And Shauna as well will contribute on that. That's me.
Thank you. I mean, on the British Bill of Rights, as I said, in theory, you could imagine something being drafted which is quite good. You could imagine some sort of constitutional drafting the committee from people from different parties and non-parties and from faith groups and from different parts of the country and different backgrounds to discuss it and hear lots of evidence from the public. But that's not what's going to happen. It's going to be something drafted to excite screaming crowds at a Tory party conference. That isn't the basis for constitutional drafting. And I talked about the context which we're in now. I just can't see it happening. Although, in a way, perhaps that would have been the better way to do things all along, and then the constitutional patriotism would have attached to it. And you could have had a technical exercise of lining it up with the ECHR, but have focused on this, our British Charter of Rights. Maybe that was a missed opportunity, but it's very hard to start from that position now. Clean air, yes, I mean, there is some discussion in the book of cases which have been brought to in relation to freedom of information or right to life in the context of people who've died. It is awkward from the perspective of the ECHR to fit in an environmental case. People have managed to get a few of them in. Perhaps if we had a proper process of drafting a British Bill of Rights, that would be something we could add, as well as anti-poverty provisions and so on, and issues like that could quite rightly be part of it. But as I said, I don't think we'd get to that if that's the last thing we'd get when we've got members of Parliament saying we should be copying the environmental and other standards of India. I don't think we're going to get a Bill of Rights with environmental standards in it. And there is EU law which protects clean air, and one of the other big issues in the Great Repeal Act is whether that's going to be protected or whether it will be up to Mr. Fox on a wet Wednesday afternoon to just cancel it and push it through with no one in Parliament paying attention to vote it up or down. Those are crucial issues. And how do we get rid of you? Well, the answer to that, as with the EC and even more so with the ECHO, it's right there in this book. Parliament can ignore any ruling of a court of the UK which says that there's a breach of the Human Rights Act by another Act of Parliament. Vote for Parliament. Vote for the people who, they can make their pitch to you whether they're going to go along with a particular ruling or not. And that can be a factor in why people vote for people. I'm sure that is a factor in sometimes why people vote for people. But that's how the system works. The compromise with parliamentary sovereignty, giving precedence to parliamentary sovereignty, is there. It's written into the Act. It's much stronger than the system is in Canada, in fact, for giving precedence to parliamentary sovereignty. So the judges can't strike down an Act of Parliament. It's Parliament's decision, and so our decision when we vote for Parliament. And I don't have a problem with representative democracy. If we're talking about the history of this country and how this country's developed and our traditions and our identity as people, it's built up in parliamentary democracy, not direct democracy. That's an alien construct. And that's what we should be defending.
Shauna.
Yeah. Yes, on the environmental law point, clean air, well, so much of our environmental provision comes from the EU, so that is going to go with Brexit, partly because an awful lot of environmental law comes from decisions of the European Court of Justice. And one thing is clear, that the European Court of Justice is certainly not wanted. That's one of the things that's definitely going to be dealt with in the Great Repeal Bill. Things like the definition of waste, for example, that is there in decisions of the court. What is going to happen to that? Very unclear, but I doubt they'll survive very much. This point, well, how do you throw the scoundrels out? How do you get rid of politicians that you don't like? Well, there is provision in EU law. You can vote for your MEP. The government has voting rights in the Council of Ministers. If they don't like something, they can vote against it. We can lobby our MPs to make a point in Parliament, make a point to the government. Aside from that, what about the 48% who voted to remain in the EU? Certainly, you could vote Liberal Democrat, and I realise that that can have real results. But aside from that, there isn't any very obvious route for a lot of people who might have been tempted to vote for another party. Some people are positively disenfranchised in this. EU citizens who are living in the UK, EU British nationals who are living elsewhere in Europe have not had their voting rights upheld. So I think that there's this disenfranchisement is going on nationally as well. And I agree with what Steve said, that when it comes to decisions on human rights cases, government doesn't have to do anything. Point made by Lady Hale as well, which you cover very much in your book. And that is a perception that has not been publicised enough. And I think it's very important.
Right. I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap things up now because I want to give everyone the opportunity to interact with our speakers at the reception outside and, more importantly, to buy your copy of the book. So I hope I made up for my earlier omission. But before I let you go, let me say a couple of things about some public events in the Lent term. Just advertise a few things. On the 19th of January, we have the first public discussion of the Competition and Markets Authority report on the legal services market with the participation of the CMA, of course, the Solicitors Regulation Authority and the Law Society. On the 6th of February, we'll be discussing stale crimes and whether there are good reasons to have statutes of limitations. And on the 13th of March, we have our professor in practice, who also happens to be Shadow Attorney General, Shami Chakrabarti, in conversation here on this stage. So, thank you all very much, and please join me in thanking our panel.